Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is excerpts from a panel held at the No to NATO, Yes to Peace conference in Washington, D.C. on July 6, 2024. The conference was a counter-summit to NATO's 75th anniversary summit held the following week. We start with Sevim Dagdelen, a member of the German Bundestag since 2005. In her latest book, NATO, A Reckoning with the Atlantic Alliance, Sevim Dagdelen dispels the myths of NATO and analyzes how the military pact, with its expansive geopolitics, is driving the world closer to the brink of a Third World War than ever before.
Dear friends, just in time for its 75th anniversary, NATO has dropped its mask. And the NATO summit in Washington is one particularly illuminating moment in this revelation. The history of enlightenment teaches us never to accept a person's or an organization's self-image at face value. So do the early sources of enlightenment ideas in ancient Greece. The Greeks already possessed that insight. Inscribed above the temple of Apollo was the maxim, "Know thyself." If we make that injunction not lightly as a gentle reminder of the limits of human thought, but also as meaning what the pre-Socratic Greek philosopher Heracles insisted, that it belongs to all men to know themselves and think well, then we must regard self-knowledge as an essential human quality, which perhaps also ought to apply to our organizations. With NATO, however, it seems to be exactly the reverse. For NATO, denial of its true nature is part of the essence of the organization. Or put it another way, an almost meditative immersion in its own self-image is part of the essence of the military alliance. It is all the more astonishing, then, that Western media are so often content to reflect 1,000 iterations of this self-image back to the public without question and without pausing to consider whether the image adequately represents reality. In fact, 75 years of NATO is equivalent to 75 years of denial, though with a dramatic expansion of scale and scope in recent years. This is so in part because the three great myths of NATO are now fading. First, it is the central myth of a NATO organized as a defense community committed to international law. A NATO that is a community of constitutional states upholding the law, allowing international law to rule its action so that it exists for no other purpose but to defend the territory of its members. Yet, if we interrogate NATO's actual policies, what do we find? In 1999, NATO itself conducted a war of aggression in breach of international law against the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. NATO's war crimes included the bombing of a television station in Belgrade and an allegedly accidental bombing of the Chinese embassy, which killed 3 Chinese journalists. In 2011, NATO attacked Libya. It misused a UN Security Council resolution to fight a war for regime change, one result of which was that part of the country came under the rule of jihadist and Islamist group. Libya on the whole was plunged into a state of appalling misery and even suffered the return of slavery. In Afghanistan, NATO involved itself from 2003 in a war far from Alliance territory, only to hand power 20 years later to the Taliban. Those overthrow had been the invasion's stated objective. That 20-year war in Afghanistan was marked by multiple war crimes, such as the October 2015 US airstrike on a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz, which, needless to say, went unpunished. NATO has assumed the musketeer's motto, all for one and one for all. This means, in practice, that the deeds of individual NATO members must also be ascribed to the organization itself. Brown University puts the death toll of the US wars in the Middle East over the last 20 years alone at 4.5 million people. Wars like that in Iraq, based on lies and which were nothing but egregious violations of international law. NATO's self-defense, self-image as a community of defense in adherence to international law simply does not match reality. We must rather draw the opposite conclusion. NATO is a community of illegality and of the violators of international law who, either separately or as an organization, conduct wars of aggression on a politically opportunistic basis. A second myth, perhaps the one most insistently impressed upon the public, is that of NATO as a community of democracies grounded in the rule of law. But if we examine the past with any care, this flattering self-presentation is immediately deflated by an ugly and shameful past. Until 1974, NATO member Portugal was ruled by a fascist dictatorship which waged blood-soaked colonial wars in Angola and in Mozambique. Those who resisted were driven into concentration camps like in Tarrafal in Cape Verde, where many Angolans and Guinea-Bissauans were tortured to death. Like fascist Portugal, Greece and Turkey, both were members of NATO in the aftermath of their respective military coups. NATO itself, as we now know, put into motion Operation Gladio, a clandestine organization to be activated whenever democratic majorities threatened to vote against NATO membership. In Italy, for example, terrorist attacks were carried out in the name of far-left groups so as to discredit the Italian Communist Party in its effort to form a government. One might object that here we are referencing a bygone era and that NATO now stands ready to be called up in the global fight by democrats against autocrats. But in this point too, any serious observer must conclude that something is amiss in that aspect of the 21st century alliance's self-image. Take Turkey under President Erdogan. It has repeatedly conducted illegal wars against Iraq and Syria, supported Islamist jihadist terrorist groups in Syria, and according to the German government's own assessment in 2016, is a launchpad for Islamists. Yet Turkey has always been and remains to this day a valued NATO member. Bilateral security agreements, such as those struck with Franco's Spain, are now in place with Saudi Arabia and Qatar, even in the full knowledge that these states are avowedly anti-democratic. Clearly, the only meaningful criterion for dealing with the alliance is geopolitical advantage. NATO is neither a collective of democracies, nor does it exist to defend democracy. Third, NATO presently claims to be safeguarding human rights. And even if we were to overlook how NATO's actions trample on the rights to work, health, and adequate housing a million times over, amidst growing poverty and a historic upward redistribution of wealth domestically, such a self-serving image does not withstand scrutiny in international matters. As we debate here today, prisoners taken in the US so-called global war on terror still languish in Guantanamo Bay, where they have been kept without trial for nearly a quarter of a century. That is the reality of human rights in NATO's leading state. When it comes to freedom of opinion and the press, the US, supported by its NATO allies, attempted to make an example of Julian Assange by tormenting him for 14 years. His sole crime was having revealed US war crimes to the public. A smear campaign was then launched against him. Hillary Clinton and Mike Pompeo openly contemplated his murder. This is a bit of the reality of NATO's relationship to human rights. And I'm thrilled to be able to say, finally, that my friend Julian Assange is now a free man. And also important, Julian is undefeated, dear friends. The international campaign for Assange, all of the confidential diplomatic talks and the like, were in the end successful. But we must also realize that the fight for Julian's freedom was also a part of the struggle for freedom itself. And this struggle continues to rage here at the very heart of the NATO system. Given the density of the propaganda, how tireless it operates in celebration of the NATO mythology, day in and day out, it is almost a miracle that not only is support for NATO crumbling worldwide, but that it is precisely those most exposed to its propaganda who are increasingly skeptical of the military pact. In the United States, public approval of NATO has been falling continuously over recent years, while majorities in Germany question the principle of defending all members. That is, they are no longer prepared to commit themselves to Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty. Why is that? Why are people starting to have doubts about NATO, despite the onslaught of propaganda? The answer is simple enough. NATO is itself causing this crisis, and people sense that. While its defenders speak of the alliance as if it were eternal, the organization's drive toward escalation in Ukraine and its expansion into Asia is exceeding the alliance's own capacities. Just as with most empires, NATO is falling into a self-made trap of overextension. And in this regard, NATO is a political fossil, unprepared to learn from the defeat of the German Empire in the First World War, and appears to be repeating the gross miscalculations of the Kaiser's Germany only on a global scale. The German Empire believed it could wage a war on two fronts. Today, a similar conviction is gaining traction within NATO that it must not only confront Russia and China, but it is also to involve itself in the Middle East. This is a claim to global hegemony now under formulation. What hubris. NATO evidently sees itself waging a war on three fronts. But if it were to do this, its defeat would be certain right from the start. Given this, it is only logical that three particular meetings are planned for this week's NATO summit. The first is a working session devoted to further ramping up the alliance's own rearmament. The NATO-Ukraine Council is next on the agenda. It is to discuss how the lavish financial transfers and pledges from NATO to Ukraine can be augmented with an increase in arms deliveries and eventual NATO membership for Ukraine. Third, there will be a session with the Asian Pacific Forum, or Asia Pacific Partners, Australia, Japan, New Zealand, and South Korea, and a meeting with the leaders of the European Union. 75 years after it was founded, NATO is to push for stepped-up belligerence in Ukraine and expansion into Asia. The intention is to advance the NATOization of Asia and to put the strategy it believes it has already deployed successfully against Russia in place there. For the moment, the primary focus in the Pacific is not on direct NATO accession for Asian countries, but rather on the expansion of NATO's sphere of influence via bilateral agreements. And not only with the Asian Pacific Four, but also with the Philippines, Taiwan, and Singapore. Just as Ukraine was erected as a frontline state against Russia, NATO is hoping to transform Asian countries like the Philippines into challenger states vis-a-vis China. The initial aim is to engage in a cold proxy war, but at the same time, to prepare for a hot US and NATO proxy war in Asia. And just as NATO enlargement was pursued under the boiling frog principle with regard to Russia, so with enlargement proceeding incrementally so as not to arouse Russia's suspicion too much, the policy of containing China now is compromised of lining up states one by one into a phalanx ready for war. The goal is, as ever, to avoid having to fight such a war oneself, but to be able to access allies' resources so as to conduct these cold and then hot wars. These developments are flanked by economic warfare, which is now also being directed against China, and the main burden of which is borne by the economies of US client states. The US and NATO are in fact pursuing a method of war laid out by the ancient Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu, who counseled that warfare not employing one's own resources was that type a state should aspire to wage. The problem for NATO strategists here is not only their willingness to set fire to the entire world, but also the self-imposed risk posed by their global pretensions, which only fosters alliances among those states rejecting NATO. Indeed, NATO policy played a major role in the rise of the BRICS countries, as that grouping is for many states a means of protecting their own sovereignty. Paradoxically then, if there are forces now promoting a multipolar world, the US and its NATO allies must be considered among the most significant. That's all about dialectics. Even states like India and Vietnam are refusing to subordinate themselves to NATO strategy. And with its unconditional support to the far-right government of Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, NATO is losing all moral legitimacy in the global south as it is seen to be complicit in Israeli war crimes. As already mentioned, public support for a NATO committed to escalation and expansion is crumbling in the West. In Germany, 55% of people reject Ukraine's accession to NATO. The majority opposes supplying arms to Ukraine and desires an immediate ceasefire. In the United States, financial aid to Ukraine, $200 billion so far, has become extremely unpopular. Growing numbers of people want a stop on the flow of money to a system in Kiev, which is not only corrupt, but honors a far-right state cult around the Nazi collaborator and mass murderer Stefan Bandera. Dear friends, NATO's myths are losing their luster. The alliance's strategies are falling to their own imperial overextension. What we need now is an immediate end to arms deliveries to Ukraine and, at long last, a ceasefire there. Those who seek peace and security for their own populations must halt the aggressive policy of expansion into Asia. Ultimately, the fight against NATO is a fight for one's own sovereignty. As an alliance of client states, Europe is in danger of collapsing. Emancipation, as seen in Latin America, has yet to materialize. A first step would be to stop letting ourselves be played for fools by a military alliance that funds its aggressive strategy with a social war waged by its constitutive governments against its own populations. Therefore, I thank you for your attention and for having me in this event. Thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you. You know, we need to have a little music in these very important gatherings. And we have a great singer that's here, Ben Grosskopf, who's from Western Massachusetts. And he's been around a long time, and he's got a couple of NATO songs. And he's going to start out, though, with one called Uncle Sam Sees a Shrink.
Okay. Thank you, Ann. Thank you. My goodness. You know, I've been spending the last 75 years of my life ordering the global system to support my economic interests. And it's tiring. I'm tired. I'm sad. I'm exhausted. I've been seeking out psychotherapy. Oh, let's get this clear. My name is not Ben Grosskopf. My name is Uncle Sam, all right? And thanks for the intro, though, Ann. This is what I told my shrink last night. So what brought me here, shrink, is I started to think that perhaps I've gone into decline. I almost forget when the sun never set on countries whose rules I define. My unrivaled power meant nations would cower and help my vast wealth to accrue. If one wasn't supine or they got out of line, well, I'd just take them out in a coup. And I have by far the best nuclear warheads. Each one is on trigger alert. My hundreds of foreign bases are spread to maintain the control I exert. So, doctor, help me. I can't understand why wielding this power feels pointless and bland. Even with all my arms, my wealth and grandeur, I still feel so insecure. So insecure, so insecure. Even with my grandeur, I feel so insecure. So be frank with me, please. I'm down on my knees. Your words come with weighty credentials. Why am I in this pain? Can you help me regain the status of being essential? It just makes me irate when erstwhile client states demand that I honor their borders. I feel anxious and sick. Check the diagnostic manual of mental disorders. What's the assessment at which you've arrived? And where's it described in this text? Well, I'm paging up there right now in the DSM-5. Just tell me the section heading again. The military industrial complex? Wow! You found my complex. You found my complex. I'll read next from this text where you found my complex. It says the symptoms are fraudsters and hacks win the biggest contracts, building jet fighters and drones. Economies go down in the cities and towns once lenders start calling in loans. Doc, my global franchise runs on free enterprise. You're missing my problem's causation. Just help me to see all the threats facing me, like the meddling done by foreign nations. Or do you mean to imply that the very armed forces, key to the power I've known, empty me of my best resources and cause me to feel so alone? Feel so alone, feel so alone. Don't tell me you've known why I feel so alone. My consultants attested that you were the best, but I clearly see now you're a phony. I pay you too well to be left in this hell of the stress that comes with hegemony. This session has only made me feel more ill and thrown your prestige into doubt. You should have known I'm a shining city on a hill. We're done now, and I'm walking out.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. That was Ben Groskop singing his song, Uncle Sam Sees a Shrink. Next up is Joo-hyun Park, an organizer with NotiTall for Korean Community Development. NotiTall focuses on organizing the Korean diaspora along anti-imperialist lines.
It's a real pleasure to be here with you all today. I want to extend my gratitude and the gratitude of Norutol to the organizers of Noda NATO Yes to Peace. Also want to just extend respect to all the fellow panelists who've already appeared before me. My name is Chuhyun. I'm here representing Norutol for Korean Community Development. Shin gave a little bit of an introduction to our organization. If you're not familiar, Norutol is an organization of Korean diaspora and our comrades based here in the United States. And for more than 20 years, actually, I guess this year is our 25th year, we have been organizing and mobilizing to raise consciousness of US imperialism in our homeland, to build people-to-people ties between not only diaspora youth here in the US, but also among the US left, with people who are deeply involved in the struggle for liberation from imperialism in Korea, whether that's on the southern side of the peninsula or on the northern side. Throughout our history, we've organized 11 delegations to the DPRK or to North Korea. That work has been paused for the last 7 years because in 2017, the United States imposed a unilateral travel ban preventing US passport holders from visiting the DPRK, which still stands to this day. So given our organization's long history of focus on questions of peace and demilitarization in Korea, we naturally see the global expansion of NATO as a paramount threat to peace and sovereignty in the world today. And we are especially concerned by Korea's role as a sort of ground zero in the formation of Asian NATO. And that's something I want to get into more today. Now, as pretty much every speaker who's come before me has already established, NATO as an alliance really has no defensive purpose. NATO is just a mechanism for the United States to weld together the various powers of the Northern Atlantic behind support for imperialist wars around the world, which primarily serve to uphold the US's financial and military hegemony on the planet. Now, today, the greatest threat to that hegemony comes from China. And the reason for this is because China has achieved a combination of economic prosperity and political independence that allows it to challenge the US on the global stage. And not only to assert its own independence, but really to provide other countries with an alternative path to development than through the United States, the IMF, the World Bank, the entire Bretton Woods system. So back in 2020, the NATO Secretary General released a report called NATO 2030. Which identified China as a systemic rival to the Western bloc that NATO represents. Now, it's definitely curious that NATO would have anything to say about China at all. I think this is a very informed audience, but in case anyone is not aware, China is not in the Atlantic. I will say that once again, China is not in the Atlantic. So, what that signals to us is that the US ruling class has reached a point where it sees war with China as both inevitable and desirable, because this is the primary way to maintain its position of dominance in the world system. Therefore, there is a need for an Asian NATO. Similar to China, Asia is also mostly not in the Atlantic. So what is Asian NATO? When we talk about Asian NATO, what we mean is the formation of a new military bloc in Asia and the Pacific, which is dominated by the United States. This idea is not necessarily new. It's something that the US has sought in the region ever since the very beginning of the Cold War. And the US has also had a very large permanent military presence in its vassal states across East Asia and Oceania since the end of World War II. But what's changing now is that these vassal states, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, Australia, et cetera, are being brought into increasingly larger alliances that link them to one another in addition to the US. And the result is the formation of a sort of super alliance, the gradual building of a single unit that thinks and acts like one army. So far, we have a few building blocks of the system in place. We have AUKUS, which is the security pact between Australia, the United Kingdom, not in Asia, and the US. We have the Quad, which is primarily a security dialogue between Japan, India, Australia, and the US, which recently conducted naval exercises with the Philippines. We have JACIS, Japan, the United States, and Korea, which are forming a new trilateral military alliance. And then we have Five Eyes Plus, which refers to the Five Eyes countries that engage in an intelligence dialogue, specifically with Japan and South Korea, concerning military developments on the Korean Peninsula, so the DPRK or North Korea, and China. And what we can clearly see is that the purpose of this alliance is to encircle China militarily and not only prepare for, but actively provoke a situation of war, some kind of confrontation that can be used to bring about a collapse of China's political system and extend the reach of US imperialism in the region. But where does Korea really fit into this? It might not be immediately obvious, but the point I want to argue today is that Korea is the keystone of this rising Asian NATO. What I mean by that is that Korea has become the essential piece of the puzzle that makes Asian NATO possible in the first place. And that's different from understanding the objective of Asian NATO, which is still primarily centered around China. Additionally, Korea is now the most volatile flashpoint in this new Cold War. It's the place where a confrontation is most likely because it's the place where the US is making its boldest threats and escalations. So because of those reasons, there is a very urgent need for the anti-war movement, the anti-imperialist movement, to gain a better understanding of the Korean situation and its strategic centrality to both the imperialist forces and correspondingly we, the anti-imperialist forces of the world. The first thing we need to understand is that in the last few months, there has been a paradigm shift in Korea. For more than half a century, the DPRK, North Korea's approach to the question of security in Korea was primarily premised on the idea of peaceful, independent reunification, seeing the ROK, the Republic of Korea, the South, as a partner in that process. That era is now over. At the start of this year, there was a speech delivered by General Secretary Kim Jong-un in which he clarified that the strategy of peaceful reunification would be departed from because 50 years of practice, 50 years of real-world experience had demonstrated that it was no longer viable. What was the reason the DPRK found this approach no longer viable? It is because of the magnitude and the severity of US war threats that are unfolding in Korea at this moment. KJ previously mentioned that last year, 2023, there were 200 days of consistent war exercises in Korea conducted by the US military. Over 20 of those exercises involved the use of nuclear-capable weapon systems. That's nuclear submarines, it's aircraft carriers, it's strategic bombers. But beyond that, we also need to understand that there has been a long war on Korean independence, a long war on the DPRK that stretches all the way back to the end of World War II. As you may be aware, the Korean War ended in an armistice in 1953, not a peace treaty. So as a result, in a legal and in a military sense, that war is still a reality. As part of that war, there's the economic war that the US wages in the form of sanctions against the DPRK. As part of that war as well, there are these military threats, these constant war exercises that we've named. And as a result, the DPRK has made the decision to shift towards a strategy that primarily emphasizes deterrence rather than diplomacy, which was the case for 30 years. In the 1990s up till now, the DPRK engaged in three rounds of negotiations processes with the United States. Even going as far back as 1974, they were sending letters to the US Congress asking for a peace treaty. They have looked back on all those consecutive experiences and determined we can no longer pursue the strategy. We simply have to focus on our own defense at this time. So that's brought the situation in Korea to a boiling point. And it's a very tense situation, but the US is simply not scaling back on its threats. So far this year already, we had a military exercise in the spring, which involved 12 nations, including NATO countries, that deployed their militaries to Korea to participate in these war provocations. The United States, Japan, and South Korea just finished a round of military exercises in Korea as well. This August, the US will conduct its annual flagship exercises called Uji Freedom Shield. As part of that suite of exercises that's going to occur in that month, there will be nuclear war exercises in Korea. We are already watching a genocide unfold in Gaza. We already know that there are multiple other genocides that are playing out or have played out in recent years. The famine and the counter-revolution in Sudan, the pillaging of the Congo, the United States is behind all these things. This is not enough to whet the appetite of the ruling class. They are actively rehearsing for new genocides, new processes of annihilation that they want to implement, not in the distant future, but in the next few years. That's what makes Korea particularly significant at this moment, because it is a place where the U.S. is, in the region, the U.S. is trying many, many different ways to provoke China to instigate war. The DPRK is a separate entity, of course, but the question of peace and war in the region can't be disconnected to the question of peace and war in the peninsula. And so by actively provoking a situation there, that's building up towards a regional conflict that will involve these other primary rivals that the United States has identified. So to end today, we want to make you aware of our U.S. Out of Korea campaign. And the reason for that we're launching this is because we recognize that there is a need for active domestic political opposition to U.S. war maneuvers. Right now, the U.S. enjoys complete operational freedom in Korea. Part of that is because there are very few voices from inside this country that are speaking up in an organized fashion to denounce what is going on, to make masses of people aware of what is happening. So we're introducing this campaign effort as part of the work to be able to do that. And I realize I'm far over time, so I'm gonna cut off here, but happy to talk about this further with anyone later today. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Chris Cerisi. I am with Code Pink. And as my comrades before me said, as my comrades before me said, the title of the North Atlantic Treaty is a false narrative to mislead the public that this organization is strictly an alliance between the United States and Europe. And as you have heard, that is so far from the truth. The impact of this alliance continues to be felt from Asia to Africa to Latin America. And if anyone from Latin America can tell you, the history of U.S. militarization in Latin America is insanely violent, insanely intrusive, and the cause of a lot of the issues and crises that we see right here within the belly of the beast. There's plenty of examples ongoing, future and in the past, that we have seen that NATO would just be another tool to follow through on US agenda that they have permeated through many of the regional organizational structures within Latin America. Black Alliance for Peace has done a lot of work highlighting how immersive this violent US agenda is in organizations like the Core Group, like the OSA, like the Caribbean Organization of Caribbean States. This US agenda has no intention for peace and only violence. Every talk that the United States has entered into for fighting for peace has been dead. As my comrade in Korea said, a lot of these nations have exhausted peace talks because they understand that entering into talks with the United States goes nowhere because it is just a false olive branch to just go into military intervention. So NATO is not just Europe. NATO is a tool that the US is trying to use to activate military intervention all over the globe whenever they see fit, for whatever reason, whenever they want to. The US right now is in talks to bring Argentina as well into NATO. If no one knows, Argentina just selected their own far-right leader, Milei, who intends to bring NATO, is welcoming NATO with open arms. And as we've seen in many other Latin American countries, these places that the US wants to create military bases in, that they want to have military operations in, are not empty. They are not empty plots of land. They're not empty bases. They have people. And these people, more often than not, are Black and Indigenous people. We've seen it in Colombia. We've seen it in Cuba. We've seen it in Venezuela. These are Black and Indigenous people that the US plans on testing and building these military bases on. Right now, Milei in Argentina who is very much open arms trying to accept NATO, plans on doing this. He will tell you that these lands are empty and barren, while at the same time trying to strip these lands from indigenous communities that are already there. And they're openly willing to discredit the right to land that these people have to build these military bases. And then as we see on the ground in the United States within the belly of the beast, when everyone talks of this migrant crisis without talking about the impact that US foreign policy has on this ongoing migrant crisis that is triggered by the US behavior, is triggered by the US agenda of going into these places, displacing thousands of people from their homes that then leave. There is such a grassroots impact to NATO. Yes, there are billions of dollars in aircrafts and nuclear testing, which are all real impacts, but there is such a grassroots level of displacing people from their land that the US at best they see as a temporary roadblock to their agenda for NATO. This fundamental push of moving people off their land creates such a ripple effect of resistance, a ripple effect of occupation, a ripple effect of displacement across the Americas, not just in the idea of a North Atlantic is not just Atlantic. China is not in the Atlantic. Korea, not in the Atlantic. Africa, not in the Atlantic. It's not just Europe. And it's really important that as people who are organizing and counter to a US agenda, that we understand that this narrative is meant to mislead the public. This narrative of Russia as our enemy, of China as our enemy, is meant to classify anybody who challenges the US as an enemy. Right now, Colombia is NATO's number one partner in Latin America, something that's passed on from a previous administration. And Colombia is a really good example of how initially you have to attack grassroots local communities first. You have to push these indigenous and African communities off their land first to then perpetuate this large-scale agenda of US militarization in the region. And it's not just Colombia. If the US is able to immerse itself in Latin America, if NATO is able to become a military tool of US agenda, it will wreak havoc in the region. Right now we're seeing in Haiti a US-funded intervention, a US-funded invasion of a Latin American country using foreign militaries. And that's exactly what NATO will continue to be in the region if we continue down this path. The United States is trying to use NATO to legitimize this military intervention globally. They believe if they do it under the guise of NATO, it'll bring a sort of legitimacy that this is okay, this intervention is okay. We're bringing peace through guns and war to regions that are ungovernable and full of instability and unstable places. These are not unstable places. The US will deem a terrorist anybody who goes against them, anyone who's fighting the US agenda, the US will deem a terrorist and fight against, while creating a resistance through this displacement, while going into countries, taking people off their land, creating resistance where there wasn't. They create their own enemy. And then they label that and they say it's justifiable that we go into these communities, that we displace these people, that we test nuclear arms for enemies that don't even exist. They do not exist. And so I really think it's important to understand that this title of North Atlantic Treaty is meant to mislead the public. It is not just the North Atlantic. It is anyone who goes against the US agenda. It is not just Russia. It is not just China. It's Haiti as well. It's Palestine as well. Our resistance to US imperialism makes us an enemy. It does not matter where we are. It does not matter what alliance we fall under. Anybody who goes against this will be deemed as a threat to the state. So I think it's important to understand the grassroots level that NATO has, not just in Europe, but in Latin America. Anybody going against the state is a threat. Now, the US has continued to legitimize and delegitimize any state that goes against them. And so we're seeing now, in Haiti in particular, I really want to use Haiti as an example because NATO is going to be a military tool used to carry out the agenda that is created by the core group, another organization backed by the United States. These groups are operating without any say of the countries they're operating in. So when we were talking about the core group, we were talking about a group that does not have any Haitians inside of it, that they are now following through on a military occupation through. And so it's really important not just to see NATO as this global occupying force, but it's working in alliance with regional bodies that are promoting these anti-grassroots narratives. So it's the core group saying that Haiti needs an invasion, and then soon it'll be NATO that will carry out that invasion. And so it's really important to stop it now, stop it while we have the power to stop it before it already is working in alliance with these regional bodies backed by the US. It's important to fight for the autonomy of the people who are living on these soon-to-be bases. These bases that the US plans to build are not empty. They are not without people that are already on them. And it takes pushing people off of their lands to build these bases, to test these nuclear weapons. You have to push the people that are already on it out. And the US does not really see that as a difficult problem. They do not. But the minute they push people off their land to build these NATO bases, to test these nuclear arms, is the minute they create a resistance. And so it's really important to stop it now, to stop the impact of already mass displacement that we're seeing from US-backed militarization. It's so important that we see these grassroots impacts of these communities living on the ground in Colombia, in Cuba, in Haiti, that are then forming and organizing together to stop NATO. And if they're stopping the entrance of NATO right now on the ground, we have a responsibility as people in the belly of the beast, 4 or 5 blocks from the capital where they're planning these things. We have a responsibility to say, you cannot do this. We are here. You have pushed enough people out of Haiti. You have pushed enough people out of Colombia that now we're here. Now we're here because we have no other choice to be. And we're telling you to stop. So I really am imploring people to keep that in mind, that these bases are not empty. Where they build, there are people living on these lands who have lived on these lands for centuries. And so we protect, we fight for those on their land. We fight for those who have been forced out of their land, who are now in the belly of the beast, saying we refuse to leave again. We refuse to be pushed out anymore. We refuse to have any more of these built. We refuse to have more displacement come. There is no need to have a military base because you are creating enemies. The more military bases you create, the more nuclear arms you test, the more enemies you create, the more of a resistance you create. And we don't want resistance, we want peace. We want continued peace in the region, and building a military base does not say peace, it is preparation for war. It is preparation for war, and it's not our war, it is the US's war. It is not our war to fight, but it is our war. It is a war that we are impacted by. So I really want folks to keep that in mind. These lands are not empty. These people are not without a home. We live on these lands. Every bomb you test, there are communities impacted by the air, by the land, by the soil, the air we breathe, the water we drink are all impacted by these tests. It is not happening in isolation to everything else. These bombs are not being tested in vacant areas. There are people in every corner. When Milei talks about bringing NATO and bringing military bases, what he is not saying is that it takes pushing thousands of indigenous people off their land to build that base. Taking away their inherent right to land to build that base, to test those bombs. It is not happening in isolation. It is not happening on empty territory. It is happening to people. It's happening to people who live there, who are from there, that can no longer be there because of this US agenda of violence, of indiscriminate violence, happening not just in Europe, not just with Russia, but with everyday people who have woken up and fallen asleep on the same territory that they can no longer do because all of a sudden this new NATO military complex has to be built. And it is not just Colombia, it's in Atlanta, it's Cop City. It's Cop City where these large military bases that are destroying the land, destroying access to water, destroying the largest forest in the South that we no longer have access to. People live here. People have lived here from before and after. We will continue to be on this land, and we will continue to reject all military occupation, military projects, military testing that the US has no consideration for. No consideration. At best, At best, they would see us as a temporary roadblock in these sort of constructions. It is not just NATO. It is not just China. It is all of the Americas. It is all of the global South. It is all oppressed, colonized people. So keep that in mind. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was excerpts from a panel held at the No to NATO, Yes to Peace conference in Washington, D.C. on July 6, 2024. The conference was a counter-summit to NATO's 75th anniversary summit held the following week. Remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.